What we're dealing with here is a transcendent piece of music.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source.
I believe that from the very first measure, you feel the depth of this experience.
We're close listening to Johann Sebastian Bach's St. John Passion for precisely what upsets people in it.
We're being plunged into something that is not clear, that is turbulent, that is ambiguous, and that is seeking for resolution.
The opening tableau is one of the most stunning things ever written by anyone.
You have this quiet, pulsing string music while the winds are just playing a haunting and very dissonant line over it.
Painful, stabbing, dissonant notes.
That churning in the lower parts kind of just had the sense that the world is a little out of joint.
And that eventually builds into this first cry of the chorus. Hair, Lord.
Masterpieces of church theater survived from the great Bach's hand, both of them telling the trial and crucifixion of Jesus, one from the Gospel of Matthew, the other from the later Gospel of John. It is the musical account of a sadistic murder of a young visionary to the howling mockery of a mob of his fellow Jews. Jesus' crime was presenting himself as the Son of God. For Christians, including Bach, the death of Jesus becomes the redeeming moment in all of time. It's God's sacrifice of his Son for the sins of mankind. But in the telling over the ages, and especially after the 20th century, it's that merciless mob yelling, crucify him, in Bach's oratorio, that made St. John Passion, even for many Bach lovers, unlistenable. So the question this hour is how to make sense of a masterwork of Western art that has not just killer rage at the core, but hostile group labels in it too. It is an almost all-Jewish cast in this universal story. Jesus, Mary, the apostles, the gospel writers, the elders of the temple, all but the viceroy Pontius Pilate, are Jews in a Jewish outpost of the Roman Empire. But in the St. John Gospel, written almost a century after the event, the crowd mocking Jesus, screaming for his death, is identified not as the crowd or the mob, but as the Jews. And there's the rub for modern minds. Our conversations begin with Martin Perlman, who has led the Boston Baroque Ensemble for 40 years, but never put the St. John Passion on his program until this year. It's his performance this spring that runs throughout our radio hour. We're also drawing on the mezzo-soprano Pamela Dalal, who has sung the great St. John arias and translated its words into English, Robert Marshall at Brandeis, and Deanna Klepper at Boston University are our historians of Bach's music and the political and religious context of 18th century Germany. We're listening not just for the hard feelings in and around this music, but also for the heartrending beauty that is all through it, in music that says more and sticks longer than the words, as almost anyone can hear, for example, in the catatonic sound of St. Peter, breaking down when he realizes that he has betrayed his friend Jesus not once but three times, just as Jesus said he would. The Gospel says Peter went out and wept bitterly. This is the way Bach says it.
Most twisted, tormented, contorted, agonized, dissonant, painful music that Bach ever wrote for a human voice.
Robert Marshall is a Bach historian at Brandeis University, a Jew who was horrified by the St. John Passion when he first heard it in graduate school 50 years ago.
In my day, Bach's church music wasn't all that much performed in this country. And young musicians growing up, they knew his instrumental music very well. You studied the piano or the violin or the cello and played an orchestral instrument, and you got to know his instrumental music very well and adored it. And his church music wasn't played that much, generally, the way has been in recent decades. So anyway, I decided I was going to listen to this piece, took the recording out, and heard it for the first time, and was overwhelmed and utterly devastated by the anti-Jewish content of it. I mean, the constant reference to the Jews as being responsible for the death, being bloodthirsty, and the way the evangelist, when he refers to this part of the story, would say, and the Jews cried, Juden schrien. It sounded so nasty. At that time, this is the early 60s, the only time you ever heard the word Jude was when it came out of the mouth of a Nazi, you know, in some kind of a documentary. I could hear Joseph Goebbels saying that. And then, of course, I tried to put it in context even then and say, well, I'm really concerned with this fantastic music, this marvelous music. But I was more than a little upset by the thought that this man, whom I put at the top of my pedestal of gods, could have been involved with producing such a work.
And what did you do? What did the young man do about that? My hero is... Not my people.
I was just puzzled and baffled. I said, does this mean he was an anti-Semite? Or is it just that he's fulfilling a liturgical contract to produce this work for the service? And that's, of course, how I had to come to terms with it at the time.
Imagine, I mean, think of those choruses in which they're yelling, Kreuziger,
Kreuziger. Yeah, yeah.
It's not pretty music.
It is not. Well, it's fantastically powerful, dramatic.
Explain what's going on here. Musically and... dramatically, theologically, ethnically, any way you want.
Well, Bach is being a dramatist. This is as close as he ever came to writing an opera, it seems to me. And it was a very special kind of an opera because the chorus has a leading role, whereas in the operas of his time, there's almost no chorus at all. It's just a string of arias sung by soloists and heroes. But in the Passions, especially in Bach's setting of the Passion, the chorus becomes a great dramatic figure. And the chorus represents the armies of the Romans. It also represents the priests of the high priests of the temple, and it represents the Jewish mob in general. And they all are playing their role. And this is the story where St. John in the Gospel says, and then the crowd screamed, Kreuziger ihn, and Bach wanted to get that sense of frenzy into the music.
Describe to, you know, from your ears, what is the musical sound that Bach is conjuring for this series of episodes of contempt and scorn and mockery and hatred, and there's a murderous intent under it. I mean, what's he doing musically?
Yeah. Well, he's having the chorus sing kind of out of phase with itself to a large extent, right? They're kind of shouting, almost tumbling all over each other. And they're also screaming pretty much at the high end of their register. But then there are other choruses where he has the high priests of the temple saying, we have a law, and according to this law, he must die. And that is a much different kind of writing on Bach's part. Then it becomes very staid and sturdy and stolid and almost pedantic. And he's almost painting them as being these pedantic observers of the law at all costs. And the music becomes very square. And it's, of course, a vigorous fugue in Bachian terms. The voices come in one after the other, but in such a regularity that it's almost a parody of an academic fugue. But it's much different from that chaotic quality he gets when the chorus is crying, the people are crying for the crucifixion. So he has a whole spectrum there of choral styles and textures that he uses, depending on which dramatic character is being represented by the chorus. Is it the priests, or is it the Roman soldiers when they say, "Let us tear up his garment and divide it among us"? Then it's a different kind of writing again. Then it becomes, it's more like a fugue, but it's a little more delicate and nervous sounding. And so he has a gigantic spectrum.
I feel a lot of sympathy for people even today who recoil at this music, which is about their cousins, their ancestors, their group in a way, and it's offensive, much as it could be terrifically offensive still for black people to read the denigration of black people in Huckleberry Finn.
Sure.
Or in a funny switch, the anger that Palestinians say would feel reading the story of David and Goliath. And the King Saul's order that, you know, you're to come back with hundreds of foreskins of those Philistines. And if I were Palestinian, I'd think, well, those are my people.
Yes, right. It's true, there are many people today who will not listen to the St. John Passion. They can't, because the Jews are being vilified and demonized.
And named as a group, Jews.
And even worse than Huckleberry Finn or any of the others, this is not fiction. This is supposed to be the truth. The God's honest truth, that these are the people who crucified the Lord. So it is, in many ways, an anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish work, if taken on its face.
Coming up, the gospel versions and the Bach version, and just who were the villains in this story. There's a history of the difference here. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In Easter Week, which in Boston is the season of Bach's Passions, pinnacles of German music from the 18th century, drawing on the gospel writers Matthew, and in this case, John. It is a grisly enough story to begin with, the torture killing of the Son of God by the old Roman device of crucifixion. But the story handed down of a hysterical mob forcing the execution on Roman authorities has at least allowed the reading that the Jews did it and bore a collective responsibility for the crime. Deanna Klepper, historian of religion at Boston University, feels there's an acute problem in the culture of Bach's time and a general problem out there still in the world today. She is speaking here on a pre-performance panel with me for the Boston Baroque audience at Jordan Hall.
I think one of the most important questions, maybe the question that we get, is not only about Jewish-Christian relations, not only about Bach, not only about this particular piece and anti-Semitism, but I think the question is also, how do we deal with disturbing elements of religious traditions generally, especially religious traditions that have a scriptural basis? So whether we're talking about Christianity or Judaism or Islam, these are all religious traditions that have a sacred text at the core and that have spent centuries interpreting and reinterpreting that central core. It means that in every age and every time, there are going to be new ways of reading this text. If the Bach Passion is at all disturbing, is at all problematic, it's only because the Gospels are hugely problematic. It's because over centuries, medieval and early modern interpretations of that gospel text added weight to an anti-Jewish core that could not have been imagined by John when he wrote it. So it's one thing for us to say that in the Gospels, John didn't have a vision of what Christianity would be, to be thinking of this in terms of Christian against Jews. It's one thing to say that when St. Paul wrote his letters that have to do with how Christianity, he doesn't even know that it's going to be Christianity yet, but how his tradition, the tradition of the Jesus followers, will supersede the tradition of Judaism as known until that time. You can go back to antiquity and find lots of openness, but over the course of the Middle Ages, that all comes down, right? So that the hostility to Jews is real and you can't deny it. Now, that doesn't mean that these texts are necessarily tainted forever, right? The question is, how do you take traditions and evolve them? How do we get our contemporary values in sync without throwing out these traditions that are beautiful? And one of the things I would always remind students around this kind of, I do play the St. Matthew Passion for students in class. I haven't played St. John, but maybe now I will. And when we're thinking about that, I'm always trying to remind them that when we're listening to this music, we are meant to be moved. We are meant to be transformed. It's not just some kind of secular aesthetic experience, but you are supposed to personally, this is all happening right before Easter, right before the most holy time in the Christian calendar. You have 40 days of Lent. For some of you, that's what happens after Mardi Gras. Others of you know about Lent. And during that period of Lent, it's really meant to be an introspective time. Bach has a community there gathered together in church. There will be a sermon in the midst of this. And what he's trying to do is to help bring people to a place where they can appreciate a Christian understanding of sin, and a Christian understanding of the solution to sin and reconciliation with God. That said, I don't think there's any way around the problem that having Jews be the stand-in for all of humanity's sinfulness is not acceptable to me. And I'm a medievalist. I see this in medieval sermons where you'll see during Lent especially, a figure that's usually used to represent Jews and their evil is taken up by Christian preachers to say, you know, you take your inner Jew and banish your inner Jew. We all have a little Jew in us, and that's the bad stuff, and you're going to banish it because you're preparing for Lent. It's part of the tradition. It's not a pretty part. So I would say that this is, you could find similar things certainly in Islam, similar things in Judaism, similar things in Hinduism, in any tradition. You're going to find disturbing elements. And I would say the question is, how do we deal with them? And my answer in part would be you listen to the music, because you can't, if you ignore it, you miss the opportunity to rewrite the story.
That was Deanna Klepper, historian of religion at Boston University. Martin Perlman made his reputation over the last 40 years conducting the masterpieces of 17th and 18th century Baroque music, with one significant omission, Bach's St. John Passion. We are listening here to his first performance of the piece with his Boston Baroque Ensemble this Easter season at Jordan Hall. In conversation, Marty Perlman is hesitant in voicing his reservations over the years. They weren't about Bach the man, much less about Bach's music. They had mainly to do with putting himself at the center of a production in which a mob called the Jews was running riot.
I don't think it really struck me until I was faced with the possibility of performing it. And my first reaction was, I don't think I really want to perform it. How do you get inside this? Because it was a message that was disturbing to me.
What was the message?
Well, the message of the Jews being essentially a criminal mob and placing the blame so particularly on Jews. And I never felt that it shouldn't be performed. It was just a question of whether I could inhabit that. But I think I came to feel eventually that it's a part of the culture that's a part of me. I was thinking about how about a dozen years ago, I went to Poland with Boston Baroque to perform. And almost exactly 100 years before, my grandfather, whom I never knew because he died before I was born, but my father's father, who was an Orthodox rabbi, extremely strict, emigrated from the Polish-Lithuanian border, that shifting border, to the United States. And 100 years later, here was his grandson going back to conduct Messiah on Good Friday. And it just struck me at the time that our definitions of ourselves can be so much broader in a sense. I am Jewish, I'm an American, I have a European background and culturally, many things. And this is part of that background that I grew up in. I'm not conducting a church service when I do this piece. I'm putting on a concert.
It was Marty Perlman's idea that one way to deal with the ambiguities around St. John Passion was simply to talk out loud about them with his musical audience before the show went on. And we did. Bob Marshall, on stage at Jordan Hall and later at home in Newton, opened up about his own full-hearted and very Jewish embrace of this piece.
When the work is performed today, it seems that the modern Gentile listener doesn't think of this as a reason to feel fury against the Jews. Quite the opposite, it seems to me. First of all, it seems that the Gentile listener, the believer especially, will say, yes, well, this all happened 2,000 years ago. It was part of the biblical prophecy and the plan of God to have Christ come to willingly take on the sacrifice for the salvation of mankind. And we are to rejoice in his sacrifice and, if anything, feel that we shared in his persecution and crucifixion because we are all sinners and he came to absolve us of the sins. And that this happened among the ancient Romans and the ancient Jews, that is kind of irrelevant. That's background noise. But the Jews can't hear it that way. When a contemporary Jew today hears it, he, in the wake especially of the Holocaust, he thinks this is poisonous. This can lead to real violence. But then I was thinking the other day, when the work was actually performed historically with Bach in his church, first of all, there would have been no Jews in the congregation of the church. There probably weren't even any Jews living in Leipzig at all, much less would they have gone to a Good Friday service. But what about the people who did go? What did they hear? And they may have gone in saying, yes, I don't like the Jews. We know everything about the Jews and why we shouldn't like them. And that, in fact, you know, they killed our Lord and all the rest. And then he listens to the work and he comes out the other side, leaves the church and says, well, how do I feel now about the Jews? Do I hate them even more than I did before I heard the work? Or do I actually understand that they were just being an instrument of the salvation story and that actually the message is that we all are responsible for the death of Christ, and he had to die because it was part of his sacrifice and his mission, and that is what Mr. Bach, our cantor, has been telling us in his arias and his choruses about this work. And I would think, if anything, they came out less anti-Jewish than when they went into the performance, and at the least, they probably felt no more anti-Jewish than they did before. So the work was a neutral or maybe even positive in terms of making the people have a larger understanding of what the Jewish role in the Jesus story actually was.
When the soldier strikes Jesus.
Yes.
And the question is, how dare you? Who's attacking my Lord? Bach writes this beautiful piece for the chorus in which he says to an original lyric, so to speak, no, I,
exactly
it was me.
Right.
It was me who did
crux.
It.
That's the crux of the work in terms of that message, right? Where the chorus sings, who has struck you so? Wer hat dich so geschlagen? And then it's a very delicate, gentle melody. It isn't a fierce thing. And then in the second strophe, sung to the exact same music as the music where the question is asked, he says, I did. I, with my infinite number of sins, have caused you this agony. There it is, really made as explicit as possible that the ultimate villain in the piece is humanity in general. And they were playing their role as much as the Jews were, as much as Pilate was. Everybody was playing a preordained role.
So you were horrified as a young man?
Yeah, because I heard the shrieking and put it in the context of the Holocaust and the Nazis, the Goebbels, and the German language, of course, played a bad role too. In those days, you never heard the German language being spoken unless it sounded like it was being spoken by Nazis.
So where
if
do you
go back to the 1960s?
So on a scale of 1 to 10, rate it for offensiveness in your grown-up understanding.
The work? Well, I like to think I'm more enlightened about it now, and I don't even think it goes on that scale. I think it's in some sense something of an exoneration, because the Jews are part of the scenario, but the message being proclaimed, spoken as a sermon to the people listening to this work, especially in a church, but even to those in a concert hall, is that this is a universal message, and we are all part of this crime, this deicide. Am I rationalizing too much? No.
It makes complete sense to me.
I mean, since I have taken the trouble, if you will, to try to understand the Christian theology behind this more than most Jewish listeners, I think, do, I think I'm able to put this into that kind of a larger context than most of my co-religionists can. They hear the nastiness of the crowds. They hear that German language, which for them already still has some of the taint from the Nazi period. And when you have lines like "Die Juden schrien," they hear that word "Jude," the way it came out of the mouth of Hitler and out of the mouth of Goebbels, and they hear it now in the St. John Passion. And it's hard for them to erase it. And now again, where there is a lot of Jew hatred fomenting in lots of places, they feel it is very, very dangerous to perform this work.
We don't keep playing this for what it says about Jews. We keep playing this because the music is beyond the beyonds,
yes,
expressive and sad and forgiving and beautiful. One, two, or three moments as a Bach scholar that move you most musically?
Yeah. Well, I think the moment like in the Es ist vollbracht, where it is now done, and we have a viola da gamba solo, a very gorgeous piece of music. You almost think you're listening to an adagio of a sonata for the viola da gamba and continuo. And it's elaborate, it's mournful, the lines fall, most of them, or they're very jagged. They're just full of a lot of expressivity. And then the voice tells you what it's all about. It's Christ noticing that the mission is now completed. Thank you.
Coming up, how great music trumps the words it's written to. The singer Pamela Dalal reflects on the real power of St. John Passion.
The more years that I have worked with the music of Bach, I'm more and more convinced that Bach's entire purpose is to break through our complacency and take his music and pierce into our souls in a way that we cannot defend ourselves against.
This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. Listening again to Johann Sebastian Bach's St. John Passion. It is musical theater, almost an opera, about the trial and execution of Jesus. But it's not the words of the story that make this passion immortal. It's the beauty of Bach's musical means recounting the mystery of a redemptive murder, a colossal miscarriage of justice that Christians take as their liberation on earth and in eternity. As the singer Pamela Dalal tells it, the grand design of the St. John Passion and the smallest details express Bach's utter mastery of colliding emotions, those deep paradoxes of the life-saving death.
I think that there are going to be debates till the end of time about the message of this piece and, you know, is it hateful? Is it transcending its time? But really, we can get so distracted by the text, and the reason we come back to these pieces again and again is this unearthly beautiful music. Bach has a power that I don't think any other composer has ever had to affect us physically, spiritually, emotionally through sheer musical means. So I want to start by talking about this amazing moment almost directly in the middle of the St. John. It comes immediately after the description of Jesus being whipped, being scourged. And it's horrific. He's brought out, and the evangelist sings this vicious, virtuosic melisma where he's being scourged. It almost feels physically like we're being whipped ourselves. At a moment such as this, this arioso, this very quiet, very gentle, very intimate piece asks us to consider what we are seeing, and in this very Baroque way introduces all of these emotional paradoxes: anxious pleasure, bitter joy, talks about the sweetness that comes from wormwood. Bach is being handed these images by his librettist. What he does with them, this is the magic.
Hängst dich empfehlen.
he weaves this melody that continually caresses us with these intervals, the minor seventh, that which just lowers the temperature. I feel the writing in this piece, it's so sensual, it's almost erotic. The images are very startling. He's talking about the crown of thorns, the piercing, and how we are supposed to see these as images of joy, images of love. At one point, he talks about the little flowers, the little keys of heaven, Himmelsschlüsselblumen. It's like a little daisy. And the image is that these little daisies are sprouting from the thorns.
So Jesus is dead, but Bach and his passion are not done with death or with the stages of grief and consolation. One of the late peaks of the St. John Passion is what sounds like hysterical sobbing in a high soprano voice, accompanied by what could almost be a jazz duo on flute and oboe da caccia. Again, Pamela Dalal is our guide.
The final aria that we hear in the St. John is an aria for soprano, which the text is, "Dissolve my heart in floods of tears." And where Es ist vollbracht is the moment of death, of witnessing the death. By this point, the death is processed, and it's possible to fully engage the grief. Here we're scored with an English horn or an oboe da caccia and a flute paired together with this very odd color, and a high soprano who explores almost all the extremes of her range. It's often done in a kind of an ethereal way. To me, this is, again, the physicality of Bach. It's like a crying jag. You start to sob, and then you can't stop. And there's a driving energy to the accompaniment that, to me, represents that same kind of, like, the solar plexus contracting. Bach, in such a profoundly human way, understands that when you're that distraught with grief, you can't hang on to it. So, in fact, even those words, which sound like maybe we have some point of stability, dissolve into this sort of wild melisma. Then, in the middle, the text goes on to say, "Tell the world and heaven the news, my Jesus is dead." And there's something very blatant and raw about this statement, "My Jesus is dead." And every single time, he has the singer repeat these words an extraordinary number of times, which to me also feels very true. You know, there's the four stages of grief, and the first one is denial. And once you get past denial, you almost indulge in wallowing in the truth of it, that you can't stop saying it over and over. This is what's true now. He is dead. And tot, it's such a harsh, dry, ugly word. Every single time it happens, something happens in the music. The first time, all the motion stops on a kind of very strange chord, as if, well, how did we get here? Then a sort of simple, quiet cadence in a foreign key, occurs, and then it sounds like, well, we're going to go back to the beginning. The orchestra begins again. The singer interrupts them and says, I'm not done saying my Jesus is dead. There's a marking in the score that's so outrageous that nobody really knows what Bach meant. He writes what looks like a trill that's supposed to last over two entire bars of the word tot. Bach actually tells the singer they're supposed to kind of pulse the voice. So he's writing blatantly on the score, this is so intense emotionally that I need you to do something with your voice that almost transcends singing. Bach has this way of not only, I think, harmonically, he is a master, but he's also a master of leading us somewhere with a melodic figure. He's a master of rhetoric by knowing how often to repeat a word, how to change its meaning, its valence, by changing the shape of the melody.
The burial of Jesus is enacted in the final chorus, Ruht wohl, meaning, rest well, you blessed limbs, but it is not the end of the piece. From that out-of-joint opening chorus, in effect the warning label of trouble ahead, the question for all of us is, what have we been through? Where has Bach's St. John Passion delivered us? And what has been settled?
Well, it's like a lullaby, almost. Peacefulness now, as the task is done, Christ is being laid in the grave, and he will rise in a couple of days, and in the meantime, we have this moment almost suggesting an infinite time will pass. There is grief, but there's also solace to it, it seems to me. And it's a simple style of choral writing for Bach. There's a melody on top, there's nothing interfering with the tune, and it's a simple portrait of someone being laid to rest. You might say it's a moment of the ultimate humanity of Christ.
End of the St. John does something so extraordinary and so outrageous that Bach, in fact, was criticized by the theologians in his own church for doing it. We know that the last scene of the Passion is the burial of Jesus. And on Good Friday, liturgically, that is where the service ends. And so, yes, we have this beautiful chorus, Ruht wohl, Ihr heiligen Gebeine, rest well, you holy bones, and this exquisitely beautiful, tender chorus that sets that.
An amazing moment of reflection and sadness.
I think I feel somewhat consoled. I think that final lullaby is a consolation. There are no hard edges to it. It's very restful. The phrases fall. It's in almost a dance-like meter. It's in triple time. And it's unpretentious. Given all the excitement that Bach had put into earlier chorus numbers of the work, this one is very straightforward.
Death is Bach's greatest subject. It's the subject that he is the most eloquent on, that he explores over and over again and tries to come to terms with. But this final chorale is hair-raising, I think, in the most literal sense. The idea that we want freedom from suffering, we want freedom from division, we want freedom from death, and a sense that all will be joy and peace. And Bach is tapping into something that is so deeply embedded in all of us that you don't have to believe one theology in order to understand the profundity of what he's writing. But Bach adds another piece. He adds a chorale. And this chorale starts with an image not of Jesus' death, but of our own death. When I am on my deathbed, send your angel to take my soul to heaven. And this is, in fact, a vision of eternity.
Well, at the end, I feel that I've been through a journey through this tragedy, and there's been a resolution, but there's a sense that everyone is involved in it through the chorales, and you're left reflecting on it.
There's a sense of also of exhaustion, I think, on the part of everybody, including the audience, including all the singers. And time to rest, and the story will resume at the next feast.
Thanks to Martin Perlman of Boston Baroque, Pamela Dalal of Emmanuel Music, Robert Marshall of Brandeis, and Deanna Klepper of Boston University. Thanks also to Ryan Turner at Emmanuel Music for his guidance, and special thanks to the performers at Boston Baroque. Their recording graced this hour. And finally, listeners, what do you hear in this music? Weigh in, please, with your comments at radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced and edited by Connor Gillies and engineered by George Hicks, with help from Max Larkin and Pat Tomeno. Mary McGrath is our concertmaster. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.